You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Leo Brown, happy to be with you. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. 50 minutes every afternoon, culture, current events, our Catholic faith. Back live this afternoon, like you noticed. But for the past week or so, I've been out as my wife's company, Beachbody, that she works for, chartered, which was, at the time, the largest cruise ship in the world, which apparently now there's a bigger one that USA Today just announced. I posted that over on my Facebook page. But a chartered cruise of her company, all Beachbody people, and then me, right, who not necessarily there. Kind of, yes, very supportive, but maybe not with a beach body. But what an event that was. It was exciting. Maybe I'll get into unpacking a little bit of that this afternoon. Lori Desitels will be with us as we talk to her on a monthly basis. So Revelations in Education, her website. And I saw Zootopia over the weekend, which the first time for our three-year-old to be at the movies at the big screen. He held in pretty well, so that was impressive. And I was surprised by the subtext of this movie. It was a little bit more than I expected, and we'll maybe unpack that as well. All of that and more. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour, back after this.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon. We're back. I'm Leo Brown. Happy to be with you. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Culture, current events, our Catholic faith. That's what we talk about for 50 minutes every afternoon here. Lori Desitels joins us on a monthly basis. Lori, how are you?
I'm very well, Leo. How are you?
Doing well, except I'm trying to figure out why I can't make my computer stop making noise. So I apologize about that.
That's okay.
I'm helpless right now. I don't know what's going on.
That's all right.
Welcome, and over at Edutopia as well.
Yes.
Which makes me think of Zootopia, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later on. Have you seen that movie yet?
No, I haven't, but I saw something about it today.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Not quite the inside out springboard for education, but a great message. I was really impressed by it. I think you'd enjoy it.
Very cool. Very cool.
But you want to talk about trauma and how this affects the brain and, of course, what this means, especially to kids in the classroom, but
right,
to any of us, really, right?
Oh, my gosh. Just, you know, Leo, you always say it perfectly. Living room, boardroom, classroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about all three places.
Sure.
So, I'd like to talk about it because every time I turn around, whether it's presentations or looking at research, I would have to say, and this is a generalization, but right now, our educational system is really looking at the effects of adversity on children in the classroom and on teachers and on parents. I mean, it's actually exponential what's happening right now with regard to the direct experiences and what's happening, you know, to learning. And it's amazing to me how we keep hitting these reform movements and slowly but surely, I think at a national level and some state levels, we're beginning to look at the ramifications of adversity. And I kind of wanted to talk about that today and what happens in the brain.
Sure. So where do you want to start?
So how I'd like to start, Leo, is when we talk about trauma, we tend to think of that as being, you know, just severe neglect or abuse. And what I want to clarify today is that we have in right now in the United States between the ages of 12 and 17, we have 50% of students, youth, experiencing three or more adverse conditions. This does not necessarily mean abuse or neglect. This could mean just chronically hungry or chronically tired or chronically taking care of responsibilities in a home that at age 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 that we should never, you know, a child should never be taking care of those types of adult responsibilities. It could also mean a sudden shift in the family system, a loss of job, a loss of income. You know, poverty is so intimately connected to adversity. And we'll talk about that. I want to talk about that today, too. But we know that children that walk into our classrooms, and I'm not talking about children from special education classes. Of course, we have emotional and social and academic needs with children that have been identified under our national and state special education laws. I'm talking about 20 to 25%, and that's probably conservative, in every classroom, every general education classroom. And this transcends, you know, I'm not talking about just schools in poverty. You know, I'm talking about in classrooms across the country, we have a significant percentage of children coming in and adolescents coming in feeling and experiencing deep stress. And we have to pay attention to not only what happens when a child is under duress, but it intimately affects how a child learns, how they remember information, how they process, how they transfer information. So we've got this huge push on academic assessment, you know, testing and raising the bar and closing this achievement gap. But we have children walking in every day feeling disconnected and oftentimes just, you know, mistrusting adults because they walk into our classrooms if biologically, neurobiologically unattached. And we know that the carrier of all development is attachment, because our brains are social. And so what drives our self-esteem and what drives motivation and what drives academic success, which is kind of the last rung, is that ability and that intrinsic feeling of feeling felt or feeling connected to another person, and having that sense of autonomy and having that sense of purpose.
And this, of course, is really, this is the heart of everything that you've done since you've begun all of this research, is to really find a way to begin to put this as a priority in the classroom, not
Absolutely.
Just the academics, right?
Absolutely. And Leo, I have to share with you, you know, as I shared with you, I'm going to be again at Butler University in August, and they have, and I'm so grateful, they have frantically and so beautifully created an educational neuroscience trauma and the brain certificate for educators, for health science professionals, for counselors, social workers, for anyone. And it begins this summer. There is such a need, and teachers are so hungry for not only identification of pain-based behaviors, what we're seeing in the classroom that looks aggressive or that looks oppositional and defiant or even looks shut off and shut down, not only to identify and understand deeply what's happening, but for strategies and for the research that actually create a connection so that the teachers, the students, and the families, you know, we can build almost an ecology or a culture where students can begin to feel successful. So I'm so grateful. I mean, it's a small but huge step in this overall. And I also want to add too that in 2014 nationally, I think it was the Center for Disease Control created this just ginormous study on adverse childhood experiences. And this study was one of the largest investigations ever conducted to assess the connections or the associations between childhood maltreatment and later life and health well-being. And so what this study shares with us is that these indicators, there are 9 indicators, Leo, in this study. And we know in the U.S., as I mentioned earlier, 50% of children have experienced at least one or more of these experiences. 1 out of 8 children have had 3 or more negative life experiences. And 1/3 of youth between the ages of 12 and 17 in the U.S. have experienced 2 or more of these ACE indicators. And these indicators are abuse, neglect, death of a parent, could be divorce, witnessing domestic violence, living with someone who has a mental illness or an addiction, an incarceration of a family member. And then the 2 newest indicators, one is economic hardship, and then social exclusion by peers, which is a form of bullying. So, you know, we know that these ACE indicators actually, the experience of these is an incredible predictor of adult mental and emotional health. And we can't afford not to look at these. And what, children, we spend 12,000 hours in a classroom in our, you know, educational lifespan. So we have got to prepare our educators and our administrators in really embracing these and feeling very comfortable and very, emotionally connected to these children who come in and dare us to teach them.
Mm-hmm.
And Leo, I know I'm just going on. I have to share this with you. In Northern Indiana, Michael McKnight and I are going, Michael's my very good friend and colleague who wrote Unwritten with me.
And I love what he posts on Facebook, by the way. I'm constantly sharing what he posts.
He is, you've got to follow Michael because his posts are incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just incredible. And so we have been asked to go up to Maryville, Indiana, which is almost in Chicago, because over the past several years, this district has an incredible increase of children, students that are in foster care. And they are just experiencing all kinds of emotional and social challenges in the classroom. So again, doesn't have to be severe abuse or neglect, but we see, we're seeing these indicators and we're seeing right now, I'm working in a 3rd grade classroom in a large district in Indianapolis. And this is just a general 3rd grade classroom, Leo. And out of the 26 students, 11 of them have parents who are incarcerated. And that's, it's just, it affects the brain architecture. And we can change that as teachers. You know, we can really create experiences that literally can rewire the brain and help these students to feel emotionally connected and emotionally safe.
Lori Desitels is with us this afternoon, and we're talking about trauma and, of course, the effects of that trauma emotionally and specifically what it looks like in kids in the classroom. And Lori, you're over at Edutopia, the blog over there, also revelationsofeducation.com, and also the new book, right? Which is what's the title of that again?
It's Unwritten, The Story of a Living System.
And that's in pre-order still, or is that out?
It's out. It came out January 4th, so it's available.
Good deal. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk more with Lori in just a moment. More after this. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon. We're back. I'm Leo Brown. Happy to be with you. Leo Brown, almost hour. Follow me on Facebook, Leo C. Brown, the things we talk about here on the show. I typically post and repost and all that good stuff over there on Facebook. Lori Desitel is with us this afternoon, revelationsineducation.com. You can find out more about her. Lori, welcome back.
Thank you, Leo.
We were talking before in the last segment about trauma, and really, you kind of think that it sounds like such a big word, and you think that because someone has experienced trauma, it has to be something catastrophic. But then you look at all of these other elements that, unfortunately, are rather normal, right?
I mean,
there are things that are just part of a normal household that can be traumatizing to kids, and what this even just a what is perceived as neglect or truly neglect from the parent standpoint, this is something that can be traumatic to children. And so many of these walking wounded in the classroom, and this is an opportunity really for educators who can recognize this, begin to work their through this emotional intelligence, understanding that there are ways to cope with this. There's really opportunity there. And you want to talk about some of these strategies in order to identify and to then begin to resolve this, right?
Absolutely. And so in this last half, I thought about this at break too. I wanted to share, and this I for families that are listening too, you know, there isn't a family around that has not gone through a stressful period of time. You know, we all experience that. Life is change. And one of the things that I'm learning, Leo, as a mom, and I'm learning as a teacher, and something I wanted to share this afternoon, and I've done this so often, is that you and I've talked a lot about that fight, flight, freeze response in the brain. And that's our survival response. And, you know, whether we're looking at addiction, you know, of an individual, whether we're looking at, you know, some type of, you know, catastrophic abuse or neglect, or whether we're just looking at a chronic brain state where basic needs are not being met. We have this amygdala, which are two of those, those two on each hemisphere, almond shaped clusters of neurons that is our emotional center, and it fires. And when it's over firing and when it's become hypervigilant, we literally, if you looked at the brain, we see a kind of a swollen, inflamed brain architecture in this area of the brain. And when that happens, that frontal lobe shuts off and it shuts down. So the amygdala doesn't hear words. And I want to stress that this afternoon, and I'm learning this. How often have we reprimanded or I posted on Facebook last week, never in the history of saying calm down to somebody who's stressed have they ever calmed down. Because we can't, you know, neurobiologically in that amygdala brain state, the amygdala is responding to feelings and never, ever, ever to words. So one of the strategies that we are teaching teachers and counselors and social workers, and we're actually teaching the students, is to know and to begin to understand their own neuroanatomy. And it's just critical for even as young as preschoolers to know that, you know, what's happening in their brains when they're upset, and to really begin to be self-aware, to go inside and to know what that feels like. And last week I shared with a school that when we are physically injured, we ice a bruise or a sprain, we put heat on it, we rest a physical injury, we take care of our physical injuries. But when we are in a state of chronic survival or a stress response state, we tend to tell someone, oh, calm down, or we try to use words again, and we don't take it as serious as we would a broken leg. And one of the things that we're trying to set up in many of the schools that I'm working in are amygdala first aid stations or first aid centers. And the kids really like this, and we're like sectioning off a part of the room with some ways to de-escalate that stress response. And we call it icing your amygdala, taking, you know, or putting heat on your amygdala. And so we know the amygdala, and when we're in that survival state, responds to breath and to movement. So when we talk about strategies, you could even create this in your own home. You know, I can't think of the times that I wish that someone had told me to go ice my amygdala. You know, I mean, we need to have areas that represent a ritual or a routine or someplace where we know we are emotionally safe and we can take a few minutes and we can prime the brain then to begin to hear our questions or to hear words. So I can't emphasize that enough. That's just so critical in teaching our students about their neuroanatomy. And there are so many great documentaries for children and adolescents. I think we've talked about that before. And, you know, just all this wonderful Dr. Eric Chundler from Washington University has actually an educational neuroscience newsletter for students. So it's just awesome.
Yeah. And we've also discussed these situations that escalate in the classroom, right?
Absolutely.
So where there's a teacher, there's a student, and somebody's unfortunately recording these things and posting it out for the viral video element of this. But nobody's icing their amygdala in those situations. It's just the fuel is on the fire and it's just getting more and more out of control. And that does no one any good.
No, it doesn't. And we're human. And so to, you know, and a lot of times you just brought that up. We've talked about emotional contagion and jumping into power struggles and conflicts when we don't mean to. But because emotions are contagious, we can find ourselves smack dab in the center of a heated conflict before we can blink. You know, and we have to be really aware as that caregiver of our emotional triggers. You know, what triggers us. And I think self-reflection for me, Leo, has personally and professionally changed my life over the past 7 years. I think really looking at some of the things that I've not done well and some of the things I could do better and really taking a hard look at some of those deficits that really are opportunities for growth have been huge. And when we model that for students, when we share and we are really transparent, it makes a difference. So if I have time, I want to share just a couple more that I think in the classroom, one of the best things that we can do and model because of our mirror neurons, modeling is huge, is to co-teach, co-design, and help allow our students to lead with us in the classroom. So when I say co-teach, if you're teaching a topic, a child who, you know, is typically agitated, is typically resistant to learning or sitting still or being a part of the class. You know, we know that children will always and adolescents will always, always, always look misbehaved before they look stupid. And so when we invite them to participate and co-teach, maybe help design a little three-question quiz and maybe have them plan a lesson with us, it's so powerful. So many of my teachers have loved the strategy because it puts them in a role of leadership and serving another. And then quickly, this is an old strategy, but it's just Michael taught this to me. Michael McKnight reinforced this, and it's validation. And when we validate when we validate a child, we are actually indirectly saying, I hear you, I'm here, and I understand. So simple phrases like, that must have made you really feel angry, that stinks, how frustrating, what a horrible feeling that must be, what a tough spot you're in, actually emotionally connects you to that student. And if you're off, they're certainly going to tell you. And if you're right on target as to identifying how they're feeling, they're going to give you more information. So once that amygdala has cooled off and through breath or movement or space, then we can really look at the power of validation and really incorporating a child's strengths and their interests into helping to co-leading and to co-teaching and co-designing our classroom culture and instruction.
You're talking about Michael, who you was your co-author on this recent book.
Yes.
I'm looking at his Facebook page right now because, again, he posts this stuff constantly, and it's just great. And this one that I just saw, which, of course, is perfect for what you're talking about, says the kids who need the most love will ask for it in the most unloving way, as that's a Russell Barkley quote. And, you know, so you see this stuff coming out that is really, you know, it may manifest itself in this type of behavior, which, as you say, looks disruptive. And mm-hmm. that's what you see happening first. But it really is now, if you can focus into turning that into this kind of opportunity, that's the tough stuff, though, right? And from a parent standpoint.
It's so hard, Leo. It's so hard. I find myself in a conflict all the time. You're exactly right. And I love this quote too. Michael shared this with me. Troubled kids are distinguished by their regrettable ability to elicit from others exactly the opposite of what they really need. Mm. And it's just, so it's really, it's challenging to do that, but understanding it is the very first and most significant step, is to understand that those oppositional or shutdown behaviors are really pain-based behaviors.
Yeah.
And that's huge.
Yeah. Well, Lori, it's always a pleasure. I appreciate you being with us this afternoon and sharing what you've shared. Edutopia.com, right? Is that the blog site?
Or I think it's edutopia.org.
.org, forgive me. Yep. Revelations in Education. We can find your site over there. Or we can follow you on Facebook as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. All thank right. you, Leo.
Lori, thank you so much. We'll talk again soon.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
More to come. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Leo Brown. Leo Brown, Almost Hour. Back after this.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Good afternoon. We're back. I'm Leo Brown. Happy to be with you, Leo Brown. Almost Hour. Culture, current events, our Catholic faith, 50 minutes every afternoon. Follow me on Facebook, Leo C. Brown. Post things like this that I found, a promoted story. These are the things that I find interesting, because is it targeted to me, right? Is it because of the things that I look at online, is because of what I dig into? Do I get these promoted things on Facebook? And we know that there's all kinds of profiling that takes place on your whatever you happen to be doing online, and then targeted ads and things come your way because of that. So I have to assume it's because I dig into a lot of Catholic media that I get this. Now, why I get the posts about scantily clad celebrities, that's another question. I have no idea why they, which actually happened to me at a Catholic Charities meeting. I'm sitting there at the committee meeting and someone's looking over my shoulder like, Leo, why is that popping up on your Facebook page? I'm like, you know, targeted stuff. It shows what I look at, I guess. But anyway, so this story I find very interesting because it showed up on my feed last night, and it's a CBS news story about the priest abuse scandal and a 60 Minutes report from literally 2003, whenever it was, that this was taking place. And they hinge it off of Spotlight, which the movie, wasn't the Oscars weeks ago? I mean, I could understand if maybe it was all kind of current, here it is, and here's the stuff. But it just seemed like an odd opportunity to open up a wound that we know was an issue. We know this. We also know, and this is the thing that I've challenged, and I can't find anyone giving me any real accurate information here to say, no, there are other organizations who have done exactly what the Catholic Church has, because the Catholic Church is not the only one who's had abuse issues, right? We got to understand that the public school system has had issues with abuse. Other denominations have had issues with abuse. Daycare centers, you name it, the list goes on and on and on, where there has been challenges with kids in the care of adults doing things that were dubious in nature. There's no one institution that's done that. The college sports have had issues, right? We know this. Again, the list is exhaustive. But when it comes to those institutions that have been responsible in addressing this, and addressing it in a way that is not just another possible way of avoiding a conclusion, but actually coming to a conclusion. This is what the Catholic Church has done. Since 2002, there has been a very responsible program known as Virtus. If anybody has done anything in the Catholic Church revolving around any kids at all, you have had to go through some sort of training. And as a result of that, you learn how to spot potential patterns that are out there, right? That we know there are predators, there are child predators who do things a certain way. And so this program is there to help you identify that. And then, of course, we put these particular controls in place that say there's got to be two adults at any time. There's kids involved with anything. We're keeping an eye on each other. We're watching very closely for anything that looks like possible challenges that could be something that would raise a red flag. We watch out for that. Not only that, but then you look at what happened with the USCCB. This was right on the heels of the John Jay reversed one back in the early 2000s, where the bishops began to self-regulate and say, you know what, we're going to issue it came from the Dallas Charter, a way to look at this from a standpoint of saying, if there's a credible, a honestly credible charge, then that's a one strike policy. That priest is not allowed back into service. And this has happened. They're immediately removed from their post, whatever it is. And in some cases, they're laicized. In some cases, they're never allowed back. If this does blow over and prove to be something that it's not credible as they had originally determined, then there could be an opportunity for that priest to come back. But generally speaking, they're gone. And I don't even know what the number has been since 2002-ish, whenever this was enacted, of priests who were just removed. They're gone. We don't see them anymore. They are not even a part of any sort of active ministry. I don't know that there's anything that strict in any other organization. And that's a question I've asked. And, you know, I find it interesting that we want to rehash this. And again, we don't want to be overly forgiving to the point to say, well, you know, we can be lax now, but that's not the case. We're to the point now where we're even more vigilant. We've continued that vigilance since this came to light. And now we have systems in place that we didn't have before. So rather than always pointing fingers at the Catholic Church and saying, well, look at those guys and their irresponsibility for whatever this was and how it developed, why don't we take a closer look and say, wow, you know, maybe they have been pretty responsible, and maybe they're doing things that could be a model for other organizations if they actually paid attention to what the Catholic Church is doing, which I don't know is happening anyway. Want to mention this. I saw over the weekend the movie Zootopia. And like many of these kids movies, right, there's always a bigger theme, a deeper subtext. And unfortunately, oftentimes there's innuendo and there could be odd things that are there that like, ha ha ha, and adults get it and whatever, kids don't. But I didn't see anything of that nature in this movie. What I did see, well, I'll take that back. It wasn't really innuendo. There was a moment of interesting, a naturalist's club where there was a scene there, but it was all done in kind of goofy humor with animals and anyway, but it wasn't as much innuendo as oftentimes is there. But what was there was a subtext, which I think is very interesting in this movie, of racism and the police, right? I mean, we know that this theme is out there. We know that this is a societal theme, which is a challenge and a major problem. And these were both very well addressed in this movie in ways that I did not imagine. I had no idea, right? I saw the previews. I thought it looked funny. I knew my kids wanted to see it. And so we went and we had fun. But I did not expect such a deep subject being addressed in this movie, which was done very effectively, I think, through this whole animal kingdom kind of predators and prey and all of this, and the way they brought it up and the way they brought it into light. And the movie on a surface looks like a movie of triumph over struggling against the things that the kind of maybe biologically dealt to you or whatever, and rising above that. But then this deep, even deeper theme of what it looks like to be a police officer this day and age, and what it looks like to be a minority, and how the cards can easily be stacked really against both of those worlds. And to see this movie address these very deep and difficult societal challenges and do it in a way that proved to me, a very effective message. Now, I don't know if anybody's going to watch this movie and walk away from it going, oh, my perspective has changed. I'm not that hopeful, but I appreciate the fact that they're willing to go there with a movie that it's darn entertaining. It's very well done. Lots of great twists and turns in the plot, and it keeps you very interested, while at the same time having this terrific subtext of really addressing a major challenge. And it was great because our 8-year-old is old enough to kind of discuss these things and to really have. And I said, you know, what did you take away from this movie? What was it that you saw? And some of those initial, you know, overcoming the difficult stuff, because doing things that have never been done before and kind of breaking cycles, all of this is a part of it. And he got that very easily from the what he saw in the movie. But then we were able to go a little bit deeper and talk about some of these other issues. And so I think it's a great movie. I highly recommend it. Take the kids. Our 3-year-old was able to sit through it again with very minor distractions, except that people were eating popcorn all around, and he just wanted popcorn for a while. And so I was trying to bribe him to sit through the movie to get popcorn. And then fortunately, by the time he sat through the movie, he had forgotten about the popcorn. So that worked out. So that was a bonus. But again, it's visually fun. Lots of action, lots of things that the little kids would enjoy. But again, I got a terrific message. And I think they did a great job dealing with this very difficult subject matter with this this very, very fun and rollicking family film. So maybe you can get out and enjoy that as well. Check out the full review from Rotten Tomatoes on my Facebook page. I posted that over there. So if you're interested in taking a look at that, you certainly can. And also see the biggest cruise ship apparently in the world, Royal Caribbean's Harmony of the Seas, which I posted on my Facebook page as well. So all we have time for this afternoon. Thank you so much for listening. More tomorrow afternoon, Leo Brown, Almost Hour. God bless.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.